Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking politics for a change. You know us, we always venture out broadly. We go off and talk about silly things like housing and health and COVID and these things. But every now and then we come back to politics. First of all, I just want to say a couple of things. There is our live show on Sunday. It's always there, the regular show, but it's our 36th one. And I suppose the reason why I'm bringing it up, because I couldn't believe we've done 36 weeks of Sundays of live pods because of COVID in effect, Martin. That'd be fair to say.
Oh, I do believe it, Tony. Getting up early on a Sunday morning is just not my deal. But yeah, I do believe it.
12 o'clock is not early.
It is on a Sunday.
Oh, normal people are up and out. Next Friday night, Rory has a live pod, Reboot 100. It will be, the details are up on patreon.com/tortoiseshack right now. If you're interested coming along, just register. There'll be a bit of crack. It won't be too serious, and I promise we'll try and have a bit of fun at it. Do avail of it, because honestly, the live shows have been terrific. Last Friday's one with the Conversatrans crew was just magic. They are a great crack, despite the fact that we're not all in one venue and we're not all this. We're doing it all remotely at the moment. Fingers crossed we will get back to remotely. Oh, get away from remotely soon. But I wouldn't be too optimistic right now. Martin's giving me dirty looks now. anyway, look, this is actually funny. We are joined by the political correspondent of the Irish Independent and the Sunday Independent, Hugh O'Connell. Hugh, first of all, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
No problem.
And second of all, you've had an interesting, you've an interesting career, and you have, but you've had an interesting 24 hours in terms of the story that necessitated this call into you with what happened around Pascal Donoghue, Kids Shoes and RTE. And you've written a good piece today explaining why it set RTE's decision to apologise has set a precedent.
Yeah, so basically, on Wednesday morning, Pascal Donoghue went on Morning Ireland to talk about, the latest with COVID-19 and the various, the announcement the government had made the previous day in terms of the gradual and very cautious loosening of restrictions over the coming months, if everything goes to plan with the vaccination and with case numbers kind of remaining stable. And he was asked about this issue, which has come up in recent weeks, which is that basically people who have children who's are starting to walk or whose feet are growing at a rapid pace can't get shoes. Parents can't get shoes for them at the moment because shoe shops are closed. They're not deemed an essential retail outlet. The Morning Ireland, I think it had a paediatrician on beforehand, and they kind of said, look, this is a really big problem and this needs to be sorted out. And there's a good medical basis for making shoes for children essential as a retail product. Pascal Donoghue was being asked about this by Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland. And Gavin Jennings put to him the point that Fine Gael had a particular history, I'm quoting this, a particular history when it comes to children's shoes. Now, a lot of listeners might have not picked up the significance of that, particularly a lot of younger listeners. But those political anoraks amongst us would know that that was a reference to the 1982 or a budget in 1982 in which Fine Gael's finance minister, John Bruton, had tried to put VAT on children's shoes, with the result that the government at the time, the Fine Gael Labour coalition, ended up collapsing because I think it was Jim Kemmy, who was an independent TD supporting that government, said he couldn't support a budget that would put VAT on children's shoes. So the government collapsed, it was an election, and it became the election, you know, that was caused by children's shoes and by Fine Gael looking to try and raise VAT on children's shoes. So when that was put to Pascal Donoghue, he became uncharacteristically incensed, I would say, because, I mean, you know, anyone who's listened to Pascal Donoghue over the years knows that he's a pretty mild-mannered, cool customer who doesn't really get flustered or fazed when he's being interviewed. But in that instance, he took umbrage at the suggestion that the possibility that his party was not aware of the health needs that young children have, and rejected the contention from Gavin Jennings, who then interjected and apologized before Pascal Donoghue continued talking and kind of said that Dr. Jennings was making an inference about how Fine Gael viewed the issue of children's shoes. And then subsequent to that, the issue was raised at the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting on Wednesday evening, where a number of contributors said what happened to Pascal Donoghue was outrageous. The OPW minister, Patrick O'Donovan, was among them. And it emerged at that meeting that RTE had off-air, that the producer at Morning Ireland had in fact apologised to Mr. Donoghue's advisor, who had got in touch with the station. And Fine Gael had also gotten in touch with the station, and effectively the producer apologised for the manner in which the question was framed, not for asking the question per se as to why the government had not designated shoes as an essential retail item, but rather that the question was framed in such a way that Fine Gael had history when it comes to children's shoes. So arising out of that, I wrote a story. I broke that story on independent.ie on Wednesday night that this had happened. And then I wrote a piece, as you say, today in the Irish Independent today, which basically says that what RTE did is, or certainly what Dr. Jennings did and what the producer of Morning Ireland did, really does set a dangerous precedent in terms of, you know, why couldn't that issue be raised? Why are we not allowed to question our politicians about past, I suppose, I want to say misdeeds, but certainly past errors perhaps by their party, even when they weren't involved in politics? Because, I mean, if we follow that to its logical conclusion, it would mean that we can't ask Micheál Martin about things that went on in Fianna Fáil before he joined Fianna Fáil, you know, that are indicative perhaps of a culture within Fianna Fáil. You know, Sinn Féin, we can't ask Mary Lou about the IRA because Mary Lou joined Sinn Féin after the IRA.
Come in exactly on that point, because you wrote within last year, you wrote the big article for the Sunday Independent with that interview with Mary Lou.
Yeah.
And you raised several of the points that you've just alluded to that you know predate Mary Lou, and that you did that yourself. You didn't.
Yeah, I did.
No one came looking for an apology from you.
Well, yeah, a lot of people in Sinn Féin were very unhappy about it and took to Twitter to point that out. But
there's a big difference between taking the Twitter to point it out, and then having special advisors in effect.
Yeah, well, I can tell you for definite anyway, Tony, that no one in Sinn Féin got in touch with me and said you were absolutely bang out of order to be asking Mary Lou about the IRA.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it was a very mild criticism of Fine Gael. And I mean, there is a history with Fine Gael, but I think it was a very mild criticism of Fine Gael that just pointed out there is a history with shoes with Fine Gael. Of course there is. But to take such umbrage to such a mild criticism, it doesn't bode well for when you want to bring in really big criticism about the past and juxtaposition it with where they are at the moment.
Yeah. Like, I think, everyone's under pressure. Like, no more. I mean, you know, the government is the same as everyone else. Everyone's feeling the pressure of this lockdown. And Pascal Donoghue's, I suppose, feeling the pressure of spending huge amounts of money that he would rather not spend, really, trying to prop up the economy while it's largely shut down. And I suppose, like, you know, in some respects, RTE were perhaps motivated to, or certainly Gavin Jennings, I don't know, and I haven't spoken to Gavin Jennings. And I should say as well that RTE declined to comment for the story that I wrote on Wednesday night. But, you know, like, I suppose everyone was a bit taken aback by how snappy Pascal Donoghue became, because it's so out of character for him, right? And I think maybe that motivated the decision to apologise. But certainly, you know, I think it was, I don't think it was the right thing to do. I think it sets a bad precedent. And I don't think RTE has anything to apologise for. I don't think Gavin Jennings has anything to apologise for, or the producer that apologised to his advisor. These are legitimate questions to be asked of our decision makers. And the issue of children's shoes, like, that's been an issue since we locked down in December. And the government did nothing about it until there's this kind of critical mass of people, obviously raising it with their local politicians, but also, you know, this pediatricians coming out rather and saying, look, this is a real issue, like, and we need children to have shoes that fit them. You know,
do you think this is a continuation of going back a few years when there was a budget came out and Pascal was given questions in advance of what was going to come up on
John Bruton?
It was Michael Noonan.
Yeah,
they were considered, the two of them worked together in different aspects, but absolutely it was Michael Noonan.
But do you think it's a continuation of that the more they complain to RTE, the more compliant the national broadcaster becomes? I mean, is there a danger of that?
Well, of course there's a danger of that, but, like, RTE is there, it's the national broadcaster, we all pay for it. I hope you boys pay your TV license. I do. And silence there.
I pay for every single subscription, every and Martin knows this, including independent.ie. So we just...
Yeah, good. Glad to hear it. Anyway, like we all have those of us who pay the TV license, we all have a vested interest in the public broadcaster, doing right by the public in the sense of holding politicians to account and informing and entertaining the nation. And I suppose RT, like any media outlet, will of course be sensitive to criticism, but the response to that shouldn't be to kind of be cowed or comply or shy away from asking the hard questions. And in fairness to RT, they, as much as any other media outlet in this country, have done a lot to hold power to account. I mean, look at the stuff that we have, the RT Investigate stuff in relation to those children with autism and the court cases. Like, I mean, that's outstanding public service journalism. But I mean, certainly, I suppose RT has shipped a lot of criticism this last year for, being seen to sort of peddle the government line when it comes to COVID-19 and the public health restrictions. And certain people in RT have shipped a lot of criticism on that as well. But I think at the same time, there's an awful lot of people, and in fact, the vast majority of people in RT, doing an outstanding job in holding our politicians to account. Yeah, they get things wrong. I think they got this wrong. But I'm sure, it won't stop them from grilling politicians in Fine Gael or the government as much as they would any other politician,
But I mean, this is, I'm sorry, but it has to be said, like, we're talking about Hugh O'Connell, the political correspondent for the Irish Independent, who would be routinely lambasted as being seen to be pro-government, Hugh.
Well, that's a criticism, but I mean, I reject that in criticism entirely. And like, I have a body of work going back 6, 7, 8 years as a political correspondent, which I think, shows that criticism doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
I'm not pushing any agenda. I'm just simply, it would be remiss of me to say that, like, when you talk about the noise, like how sometimes Twitter can set the agenda or how social media can set the agenda, and these things can actually have an impact, where we have seen with the likes of RT as well, where we've seen situations have arisen where there was complaints. It begins on social media, it begins in momentum, and you've done work with the journal, you've done work with other industries,
business house as well.
You've gone all the way through the ranks. This is your role, but also there's a cynicism there in the public of. I want to be kind to both sides. No, to both sides. I want to be kind, because there's a cynicism there that we all look and say there is actually a problem. That, and in my mind, there is a problem with the closeness of what was always called the Leinster House bubble. Anyway,
that's an old criticism of political correspondents that they're in the bubble and they have a vested interest in, I suppose, doing right by politicians because that's where they get their stories. That's, that is a criticism. I don't think it has any validity in that. I think that any political correspondent worth their salt, right, manages those relationships in such a way that they do not let go of their journalistic objectivity, right? So you might have a good contact, right, and they're a senior politician or whatever, and, the contention might be, oh, well, they never write anything negative about that politician, because they need them for stories. But you have to be prepared in certain instances to burn those relationships or to impinge upon those relationships if the story has a public interest. And I think that happens frequently in my job. Most politicians understand that, right? But some politicians don't. You could do that. There's former politicians that I've written about in the past who have never spoken to me again because I've written stories about them. Reasonably innocuous stories, I would have thought. But, stories that probably would have been critical of them. And they've literally cut off all contact with me and never spoken to me again. I do that to other politicians and they will, they will behave with me the same as they would if I hadn't have written that story. And that goes for politicians in all parties.
You mentioned that you have concerns that this could set a precedent. And of course, it means that the next time they get a question or a comment they don't like, that it's somebody's automatically going to pick up the phone. That's going to happen because that ground has already been seeded. How do we roll back from that?
Well, I think that the reporting that I've done over the last 24 hours may have an impact in terms of the willingness of media advisors for government ministers and political party press offices to intervene in circumstances where they are annoyed with a certain way in which a question has been asked of a minister on the radio. You know, I think that highlighting this intervention by Fine Gael and by people in Pascal Donoghue's office goes some way, I suppose, towards making them think twice before they do it again, perhaps. I don't know. I mean,
I think that is fair, because if you talk about the people who were involved, I mean, this is not, a minister of state or a junior minister. This is the guy who has been the finance minister for the better part of a decade at this stage. He wasn't the minister for finance. He was the deputy minister for finance.
He was public expenditure minister before between 2016 and 2017, and then prior to that he was transport minister, and prior to that he was European affairs minister. I mean, it is true to say that since I think 2013 he has been a minister in various Fine Gael governments. Yeah.
And it comes back to what I was saying. The issue there lies, where the problem lies there, in my eyes, is the chilling effect some of these things can have. You could have a chilling impact on a journalist who may want to then pull their punches, a journalist who may feel that it's, this isn't. And then also, on the flip side, as Martin quite rightly points out, someone turns around and said, oh, you can't ask me that. That didn't happen. As if history began when we all first got our Twitter accounts, although we should be all deleting those old tweets, folks. my question, I suppose, it would be that in terms of, this is a government that has spent an awful lot of money on advisors and press secretaries and communications experts. Some of your former colleagues, that maybe not directly of your former colleagues, are in there doing those roles.
And they're a loss. They're a great loss to journalism, by the way. And it's really sad that they've gone to the other side.
Not just that. They can't. There's no coming back either. If that makes sense.
No, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. There's a couple of journalists who've gone in and come back out again, but it's hard to do it. Yeah, it's hard to do it. And of course, they will always face the contention, or the criticism rather, that, well, sure, they were in on the other side. How could they be objective or not biased?
It's a strange osmosis from journalism to advisor. I think it's a strange osmosis. Yeah, I do, actually. I think if you were going to have advisors, like if I was hiring advisors in a pandemic, they would be pandemic-orientated advisors. I wouldn't be looking for journalists.
Well, it depends on what you want them to do, right? So, I mean, like every government minister, every cabinet minister is entitled to hire an advisor, or traditionally would hire someone who would handle media. And in all my years being a political correspondent, I found that the best advisors to deal with are the ones who have been former journalists, because they understand. They understand the pressures of deadlines. They understand the needs of our news desks. They understand how our industry works. Therefore, they can, I suppose, work with us on particular stories or whatever, or understand really the necessity to sometimes ask questions that are going about stories that are going to paint their minister in a negative light, They don't hold any grudges because of that, because they understand that's the gig. The best advisors are the ones who understand that, it's really important in our country to have a free and independent and fair and a media that's, free from government interference. So I think I'm not surprised. I'm surprised at the numbers that have transitioned across in recent years. But at the same time, I think Craig Hughes was on your podcast last week talking about his great Beacon scoop. And, he pointed out that the Daily Mail newsroom has been hollowed out in recent years. And it's the same across the board,
Yeah, we've spoken to Sean Defoe before. We've spoken to other people. And the amount of work that has that one person is taking on now that maybe five or six people used to take on in the past.
Yeah.
It's not good for media because it doesn't give journalists that in-depth time to pull a story apart. It's basically, it is reporting. You're just reporting what's happening and reporting and not getting into any great depth. Do you think that's a big loss to journalism in general?
Yeah, it's huge. It's bad for the industry. Like, it's bad for journalism. It's bad for democracy as well, you know, because there are so many stories that can't get covered properly or can't get reported on because the journalists that might be looking at them are just too up the walls with other stuff. Like, you know, I mean, there's plenty of stories I'd love to spend a week digging into. Plenty.
But there is money in media. It's just not filtering to journalists.
Where's it going then?
Well, I mean, right to the top, same as always.
If it was going right to the top, they wouldn't be selling it at a loss, Martin.
Yeah, I don't think that's true necessarily. Like, I mean, of course, there's some media barons in the past have creamed profits and at the expense of journalists. But, I can only speak for my organization, for example, and we were bought by Mediahuis, the Dutch-Belgian media organization, nearly 2 years ago now. And they've invested in journalism, no doubt about that. We've hired journalists, you know. So, you know, of course I would say this, my bosses are good owners. But they are, because they've invested in journalism and they've invested in journalists. But the industry is under massive pressure. There's no doubt about that. Advertising revenue's fallen off a cliff. That's been sales of prints, copies of newspapers have been hit by the pandemic. Everything has been exacerbated by the pandemic as well. But at the same time, there's an insatiable desire for news.
I push back and say it hasn't been exacerbated. It's been expedited. Some of these trends were already going that way in terms of, you know, moving digital, and unfortunately for people won't like to hear this, but introducing paywalls. These things are...
They're an essential, really.
There's economies of scale in a country like Ireland. It's very hard to have, say, a national newspaper, a national broadcast or a national platform or whatever you're doing and to making that work. But what I suppose, coming back to Martin's point, my concern is what you've kind of said, where you have to go and attend a press conference and then you report what the ex-minister has said. Okay.
Yeah.
So I can think of examples in the recent weeks where the Taoiseach has made comments in terms of, say, for example, things around the living wage, where we know, well, I know because I'm able to sit down and look and read the thing from SIP2 showing that he signed a letter to the EU saying, I object to the living wage with eight other countries. He sends this off as the EU's directive in terms of a living wage. It's hard to put that into a column, that's unfair, a report when you're just reporting the news and you're on to the next thing. And that is where
contextualizing stuff is difficult. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Because I mean, when you're reporting from a press conference, you don't necessarily have time to, there's an insatiable demand for news immediately. We have competitors, obviously, you know, part of the competition is about breaking the news before anyone else. And that goes from everything that happens at a press conference to, you know, the latest on the COVID restrictions or whatever. And that doesn't afford you the time to kind of, you know, necessarily contextualize everything to any great degree, you know? And perhaps that's where the criticism comes in of me and of others, but that's the environment that we work in. That's the nature of it, you know?
Just to bring it back to Pascal Donoghue, in my humble opinion, Pascal Donoghue gets a very easy ride compared to other ministers. He gets an extreme, and has done for the last 10 years. Do you think it's just that Pascal has been oversensitive about this and he needs to toughen up?
Well, I think your point is an interesting one. I mean, I think that Pascal... as I said in my piece today, you know, he's a very sunny demeanor, and I think that makes, and he's a very affable guy, and I suppose that makes it difficult perhaps for some people to kind of heavily criticize him. Does he get an easy ride? I don't know, not necessarily. I mean, I remember doing a ministerial ratings column for the Independent 18 months, 2 years ago now, before the pandemic, and I gave him a really low rating as finance minister because there'd been a series of issues that he hadn't dealt with particularly well in the kind of 6-month period beforehand. I think it's interesting. I mean, Pascal is coming under scrutiny within Fine Gael a lot at the moment because he was their director of elections in the general election in February. And as we all know, Fine Gael tanked in that election. And a lot of people in Fine Gael are thinking, well, you know, Pascal has to bear some responsibility for that. So his star has fallen somewhat, particularly within Fine Gael, over the election performance. And I suppose in terms of budgetary decisions, I mean, you know, him and Michael McGrath have kind of ploughed money into various state support schemes to keep the economy propped up through much of the last year, you know. So I suppose in that context, it's hard to criticise him. But where the criticism will really bite potentially coming into later on this year or next year will be if we start unwinding those schemes and then we start having to think about, you know, where are we going to pay back all this money that we borrowed from the EU? That's where the criticism is going to come, you know?
Yeah,
he's going to have to account for that because, I mean, that's an ideological thing, right?
Yes.
So there's some people who think, let's borrow, you know, borrowing costs are very low at the moment. There's money sloshing around everywhere because of the pandemic and there's firepower to beat the band. But at some point, you know, the government's going to make a decision about whether to carry on borrowing and to, you know, start paying it back when the economy is motoring again and when there isn't a need to implement tax cuts or tax increases or public expenditure cuts. But there might be an ideological decision within Fine Gael or an ideological view within Fine Gael that we have to get our books in order. Therefore, we need to raise taxes, or, you know, Fine Gael traditionally has been a party that has more focused on consolidating public expenditure, which is cuts.
Yeah, and Pascal O'Donoghue is a very hawkish finance minister. He's a very
You can't really say that though, Martin, can you? I mean, you can't say that over the last year. It's hardly hawkish.
Martin, both of you, give me 2 seconds. Yes, you can, if you look at international standards, if we'd gone another 2%, because we had much more scope in the budget than we thought we had in terms of what our tax haven Ireland actually brought in, did very well for Ireland in terms of where we were and the budget and how we overrun. And it's shown that we had an extra 2% that we could have just put towards public health care. I mean, I've run those figures against the Portuguese model and we worked out that we could have actually banked all of this up until June, or I think it was mid-June, and not have to worry based on where the figures were from last year. I would call him conservative in that regard. Modern economic.
Well, he's a member of a conservative party.
Yes. And exactly. So, but worries me, and again, coming back to the point that it's ideological, is that modern economic money theory has moved on. And we're hearing the drumbeats of old austerity in some of the missives from the department. And I think that's, you know, I don't think that's going to fly this time. I think the public understand. And actually, the other myth, and the myth that we've all played a part in, but particularly in some cohorts in the media have played a part in, they think that austerity somehow got us out of the mess the last time. And that's not true. What got us out of the mess was Mario Draghi saying, we'll do whatever it takes to save the euro. And and Ireland's borrowing rates plummeted and we were able to then actually avail of it. You know, it wasn't.
But it is the case that we implemented massive fiscal corrections at the beginning of the last decade, which it was perhaps, you know, internationally an anomaly, but I mean, it did lead to massive economic growth.
It didn't, though.
Fastest growing economy in Europe.
Yeah, every year.
Before the pandemic, unemployment was at 4%, which is like the lowest in the Eurozone.
Didn't turn until credit became cheap.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a fair point.
When money became cheap, we were able to...
But you see, there's also an argument, right? Just to take it back to Pascal O'Donoghue.
Not saying Pascal's stupid, by the way. I think he's really clever.
He's one of the smartest people in government, for sure. But at the same time, right, the policies of austerity that Fine Gael pursued, you could argue, right, have been rejected by voters in successive elections, right? So Fine Gael went from 77 seats in 2011 to 50 seats in 2016 to 35 seats last year. But you know, they've managed to stay in government because all the other parties can't get their shit together, and it could be argued that after this pandemic, if there is another election, And, you know, with Fine Gael are talking about, well, you know, we need to get our books in order and that might require some tax increases or public spending cuts or whatever, that the voters will shift away from Fine Gael even further and put them in a position where there's no way they could be part of the next government. So, you know, that would be a decision for the voters, I guess.
They've been losing popularity for a long time. It's been a fairly...
But at the same time, sorry, just to cut across you, Martin, they're 30% in the last opinion poll. Most popular party in the country.
Yeah.
But the Sunday Business Post one. And then there's the Ireland Thinks one that has Sinn Féin above them. So
I think the two are neck and neck.
You know?
Yeah, I think they are neck and neck. I think Sinn Féin, and I think that maybe Fianna Fáil, and beginning to think that too, the Sock Dems could be big players in who's the next government. Mm. But on a leadership view within Fine Gael, my dark horse for the leadership of Fine Gael is always Pascal Donoghue.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that's become less likely because of what we were talking about earlier in terms of people in Fine Gael kind of blame him or partly blame him for what happened in the election. You know,
that's a change. They usually blame the voters.
Politicians blame voters when they don't vote.
What is it about those stupid bastards that think we don't appreciate them?
But said every single politician who ever lost their seat from any party.
For the next leadership of Fine Gael, because it's looking dodgy now for who's going to lead Fine Gael into the next election, who would your money be on?
The next leader of Fine Gael?
Mm-hmm.
Good question. I think it's either Simon Harris or Helen McKenzie.
Oh my God, they're two awful choices.
I see Martin's annoyed because at last year and when we had
what about Helen Humphries, dark horse.
Oh my God.
No. I actually picked Simon last December, so that's a problem now because we have a consensus pick now. We have a problem where we agree on something, so that's an issue. Moving on from that though, and actually into that mind space in a way, I do think we could all be wrong here. I do think we could all be faced with a prospect of Fine Gael, two medium-sized parties. I said this to Mary Lou the other day when we interviewed her. I said, we don't have three big parties anymore or two big parties, and we have three medium-sized parties. But one of the medium-sized parties is falling away. And not saying that decline is terminal, but you could end up in a situation whereby Fianna Fáil are the kingmakers, or whether they hitch their wagon to the devil they know in Fine Gael, or the devil they don't in Sinn Féin, and that is very much where the real next stage goes. Because I don't know how much more Sinn Féin have declared themselves a party of the left. We wait to see when they get into government what that means. Absolutely. Like, I mean, too many people have campaigned on the left and then rushed back to the right as soon as they've gotten their seats. But nonetheless, I think that's where the real debate is here. And it might play well with the devil, you know, because that's often there's an innate conservatism in Irish politics.
Well, I think that's what drove Fine Gael into government with Fianna Fáil, that innate conservatism, right? Because there was loads of people in Fine Gael who really didn't want to go back into government. But there was just this sense in Fine Gael that, we got to do right by the country and we got to help form a government, even though lots of people in Fine Gael were like, you know, fuck that. We've been in government for 10 years. The voters hate us. They've made that clear at the ballot box.
Leo Varadkar had walked out and said, let them do it. He had done that.
Yeah. And I think the problem, Tony, you're going to have after the next election, is you're going to have two parties in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil who, notwithstanding the opinion polls, I would suggest that both parties are probably going to lose seats. Now, it remains the question as to who that benefits. Does it all go to Sinn Féin, or does it go to Sinn Féin, Labour, Sock Dems? Is it completely fragmented? But you're going to have two parties in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael who are both going to want to go into opposition because they're going to be like, well, we need a period to rebuild. And, you know, Fine Gael will be like, well, we've been in government let's say the next election is 2024. We've been in government for 13, 14 years. And Fianna Fáil are going to be like, well, we really do need to rebuild because we've lost seats, having lost seats in the election before. And they will have a new leader at that stage. and they might want a period to reflect and rebuild, in which case it will be over to Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin will have to try and cobble together a government, potentially with three or four parties. And that's tough. It's herding cats, that, you know.
Yeah, well, they've done it with the Greens. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens have managed to hold it together for...
So where are the Greens going to be?
Look. Let's not even get into that.
You're going to have two or three Green parties in the next election, probably.
Well, they're all... Everybody's now stealing the eco-socialist clothes, and that's the end.
Oh, we're all eco-socialists, right?
But that was the purpose. That was the purpose of the Green Party in the first place, was that it was an ever diminishing party as everybody else took on the policies.
But that hasn't happened in Europe, Martin. You've got Green parties now that are actually on the cusp of power in other countries, where they've actually broadened their electoral stances, and they've broadened that. We've had, unfortunately, a purge in the Green Party, and whether you might think that's a bit strong, but the talent that has left.
Well, I mean, I think they felt they had no choice but to leave. I think you're going to see more departures from the Green Party. Did you have Hazel Chew on this week or last week?
Hazel on a few days ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what she said to you guys, but certainly any time I've spoken to Hazel or people around Hazel, I don't get the sense she's in it for the long run. Now, I'm sure she'd say publicly, and she has said to me, and she's sticking with the Greens. But you know, I've written stories in the past that she's been talking to the Social Democrats. So. And then there's Nessa Hourigan and Patrick Cotsolo and Francis Noel Duffy. I mean, he's probably staying, he's married to Catherine Martin, the deputy leader. So maybe, he's kind of in it for the long haul. But, there's other countries where there's lots of Green parties. So I do think in the next election, you're going to have two or three Green parties contesting, including the original one.
That brings me to my last question, Hugh. Election.
Yeah, go on.
We are closer to an election now than we were a month ago. The idea that they're going to survive another 4 years, it's not really a runner. It looks like as soon as we are able to vote physically, that's going to be the line for the next election.
I don't know, Martin. I mean, I've been around this long enough to know that whenever people think, oh, there's an election coming soon, there usually isn't, But we are in unprecedented times, that's for sure. I mean, we're in a pandemic, and if there's one thing that would be very cleansing after this pandemic is over, perhaps it would be to let the people have their say,
I think it's inevitable, and I think it's inevitable across Europe. People are going to come out of this swinging, and they're going to come out of it swinging. People are not happy. People are not happy that they've been locked down for so long. They're not happy with the responses. And there's never going to be a perfect response to this. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to come off this and say, right, we got you through this, now you're going to get hit with austerity, well, goodbye all those parties. You're gone. Nobody's going to vote for you. Nobody.
Yeah.
I'm going to come in here and say, I do think, I don't know if an election is inevitable, but you can hear again the mood music, even within government, is trying to be softer now, because they know they are on very thin ice with the general public at this stage. They've not much goodwill left, you.
Yeah, well, like, austerity is not popular, and any move to implement austerity is going to generate a debate within government, I think. I mean, there are the hawks, the fiscal hawks in Fine Gael, for sure. There's probably some in Fianna Fáil. There might even be some in the Green Party, but they don't make up, the vast majority of each of those parties. You're going to have TDs in all of those parties who are going to be like, well, no, I'm not going to stand for tax increases or for cuts in essential public spending. And so that's going to create its own dynamic and its own friction, where you're either going to have a critical mass that are able to block what some in government want to do within those parties, or you're going to have them splitting off from those parties. So it's going to be really, 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 really interesting.
Either way, it's giving us a very clear left-right divide.
You're seeing that in the polls. Who are the two most popular parties? Sinn Féin on the left, Fine Gael on the right. And that's the country's been really fragmented. The political landscape has been all over the place since 2011. It went to Fine Gael and Labour massively in 2011, and they did what they did, and there was a huge fallout from that for both parties, particularly the Labour Party. And, Fianna Fáil, historic defeat in 2011, a recovery of sorts in 2016, but falling back again. we have three medium-sized political parties now. We have a clear division between left and right in terms of Sinn Féin and Fine Gael and maybe Fianna Fáil as well. Like, the political landscape has changed utterly. But it does mean that in the future, I think we are going to have more of a left-right divide in Irish politics. You know?
Very last question now. The last 800 years of our common travel area, were you okay with that? Like,
what was that about? That was some weird shit, right?
That's really,
but this goes back to what I was saying earlier. Like, everyone's a bit flustered by the pandemic, and I think that was just verbal diarrhea, you know.
Yeah, I think there's been a lot. I think you've been kind. I think there was an element of maybe it was word salad. Let's just be kind.
I think it was word salad, in fairness, you know. I mean, Regina Doherty, she's interesting, you know. She's one to watch. She's creating a lot of noise, you know. I mean, she was leading the charge for taking Alan Rusbridger off the media commission, along with Maria Cahill.
Let's hear she does.
Sorry, she wasn't leading. I mean, she was leading the charge politically. I mean, Maria Cahill was obviously pushing that massively, and you know, she had a very, very strong case on that front. Regina Doherty, heard her on the radio earlier on today, having a bit of a cut off Stephen Donnelly for, you know, Craig Hughes' story in the Mail today. You know, she's. Yeah,
that's
why
she's
800 years of a common travel area.
That's why she's.
I didn't learn that in school, did you?
No. It's well established that Cromwell arrived and said, "I'm only here to find out what the common travel area is like." You know,
yeah, I'm here for the duty free or whatever. Yeah.
Well, there is a reason that she's moved from Meathies to Fingal, and it's not popularity here.
She's moved because of Helen McIntyre.
They had a
fairly contentious relationship in Meathies, I believe. And obviously Helen won out in the last election, and Regina sees her political future in North County Dublin. And
but they did have the two seats. They had two seats and one Fianna Fáil in there with Thomas Byrne. And now it's not two seats for Fine Gael, and it's not two seats for Fianna Fáil either.
So who's it going to be then?
I think you're pretty much guaranteed to get Helen, of course, because that north end of the county, you're going to get Darren O'Rourke back in again. And then I think the third seat is completely up for grabs, completely.
Okay.
And it has
what about
been.
The other 39 constituencies? No, I'm kidding.
Martin's just showing off because he lives in Ashbourne, and he's actually, you know, he wants everybody to know he's actually a Meath man. That's the reality.
I was wondering, your knowledge of the constituency is very impressive. I was like, oh.
Yeah, well, as they
where's
say,
that coming from?
As they describe me, Meath-based activist. Yeah.
You were going to have to let you go because I'm sure you have a hit piece to do on the left now in the next few minutes that you have to come out and say
no
something.
No doubt, yeah.
If you could just be kind to me when you do, that'd be great.
Thanks. And just to remind folks, look,
thanks, lads.
We love having these chats. So stick your hand in your pocket, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Hugh is already paying 12, 14 quid a month into it. So the rest you can as well. Thanks.
Talk to y'all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.